Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
One House is a recruitment firm providing a tailored talent search to hospitality operators throughout the country. Empowered Hospitality provides human resources services to the restaurants and hotel sector, empowering operators with knowledge, guidance, and time. Together, we are Recruit, Retain, Relax.
Recruit, Retain, Relax. Recruit, Retain, Relax. Recruit, Retain, Relax. Recruit, Retain, Relax.
All right, here we are again, Recruit, Retain, Relax. It's Mike Hewitt here from One House and Sarah Deal from Empowered Hospitality, here to discuss the current staffing dilemma in the hospitality sector, obviously. Where is everybody? What's trending? How can operators react and adapt and survive? Our main focus is on recruitment and retention, how to find them and how to keep them. Sarah and I operate national hospitality recruitment and HR consulting companies servicing all sectors from Michelin-starred to mom-and-pop startups, giving us a unique outlook and intel on this topic. And now, let's welcome our guest. We have Annie Shi, owner of King Restaurant here in New York. Alita Maxwell, Chief HR Officer of Dos Toros Taqueria. And Camille Becerra, chef and food stylist, also based in New York. Today's topic revolves around females in hospitality, but not necessarily focus on the troubles and obstacles coming up in a male-dominated sector, but more on the success and way to keep and help other women rise up in the industry. So we're going to kick it off and talk a little bit about recruitment, and I will start off with Camille. So what challenges do women face in a leadership position, and what can male bosses do to help?
Well, I think the challenges really for me were finding a restaurant team to support my work. I think early on when I started, it was a very different environment. Women weren't staying in the kitchens. You had restaurateurs that wanted to be a restaurateur but really didn't have the level of commitment that it takes to support a team like that and the rigorous hours, etc. So what happened for me was I was kind of operating as a single mom in New York City, operating from a level of necessity. And I was going into these environments to develop kitchens, to develop menus, to develop concepts. And I just kept coming into this sort of the same experience where I would do my job and then would not get paid. And I think that was like one of the biggest reasons for me to sort of take a moment and leave the restaurant world and understand where it's at. But I will say that the shift that I saw within those years of working and seeing women stay in kitchens was really inspiring and really a great part of my experience as a chef.
And having taken a step back and gained some perspective, how do you view necessity now as you're thinking about future projects? Has your perspective changed at all in terms of how you're choosing the projects you work on, or whether you're beholden to that sense of necessity in the same way?
No, I think that I've learned a lot, and I've had to sort of put my trust into understanding that if something isn't right, to not go into it and that something else will come out. So it's been a real sort of spiritual practice as well. I'm much more happier from it.
Thank you.
Annie, similar question, right? As far as you know, some of the challenges for females in leadership positions, and also, yeah, how do male bosses, right, the boss, the owners, or the upper management, what can they do to actually help some of this and alleviate some of the issues?
So I think one of the challenges that we face and that I continue to face is the kind of even unspoken effort that you have to prove yourself to be the manager, the owner. I think we have guests come in, and especially in our first year, they would ask me, they'd be like, can I speak to the manager? And I'd have to be like, well, I am the manager.
Oh,
like,
hi,
it's me. And I think there is, especially with the older generation, they kind of like look around the room for the tall white male. And when they don't see it, they're like, oh, like, who's in charge here? And that's definitely changed as we've been around a little bit more and people know that it's a woman-run restaurant. But I think in the initial days, just even having to present yourself as a leader, or rather having people assume you're not the leader, I think having to overcome that is just work that you don't even think about, that you have to put in every single day. And now we have an amazing team. Our AGM is a man, and he is incredible at his job. And I think it's because, and it sounds so simple, like he really respects Claire, Jess, and I. And there's never, he came in like with a really open mind. And I think we've seen it with some of our other male hires where they come in and there's kind of this like, oh, like they may know the better way in some respects. And it's like, well, you're kind of coming into our space. Like we've been open for 2 years, 3 years, whatever it is. Like this is how we run things. You have to kind of prove yourself to get to a point. We're so open for constructive criticism. We're open to collaboration, but you have to like play by the rules first. And I think what's great about Oliver is that he came in, he was like, this restaurant is amazing. I'm so excited to work here. Like, I respect how you guys run things. And it sounds so straightforward, but you can really sense it in the attitude of the people you hire.
True, true.
Annie, you said something before we got started about how you decided to present your business and not emphasizing the fact that it's three women who are spearheading the opening. So can you talk about that a little bit, why you made that decision and what you feel the consequences were?
Yeah, definitely. Well, when we were opening King, obviously not a single one of us had restaurant experience in New York City. And so I think our PR company said to us, like, oh, well, this is a really great moment for women. Like, I think it'd be really cool to kind of present you guys as, you know, three young women opening a restaurant in New York City. And we thought about it, and it just, like, sat really wrong with us. And I think it's because we always, like, wanted people to come back to us because they fell in love with the food and the experience and the wine list. And, you know, I've never simply gone back to a restaurant because, oh, it's female owned. I think we wanted to just be an example of that in the city, but we really wanted King to be loved for its merits as a restaurant, first and foremost.
Yeah. Great.
That's smart. And again, it's King, not Queen. And yeah, if they really wanted to spin it, you know, on that. So I think that's smart to really give it its own, you know, ground to stand on. And Alida, so different perspective from an HR kind of looking the other way, right? On the recruitment side, among other things. What is your perspective on that?
Well, I think it's twofold. One, it's about who you choose to partner with. I think that in where we are right now, especially in New York, there's so many different choices of partnerships in the restaurant field. And so making sure that you pick a partner or pick a group of partners that will respect your opinion and will allow you to have a voice at the table is really, really important. And the second thing is, I think, calling people on it, educating people. When you get mansplained in the middle of a meeting, you know, pulling them to the side afterwards and saying, hey, what just happened? I'm not really okay with that. Let me tell you how that made me feel. And educating them as you go in a way that doesn't make them defensive, but in a way that kind of opens their eyes as to how you felt, is a way that I've approached it.
Nice. It's a nice subtle education route instead of the whip coming out.
Yeah, I find beating people over the head does not get me the response that I want.
kind of the primal male, you know, the Neanderthal thing. Hit him over the head with the...
I like to go in a less distracting way.
Nice.
Yeah, I'm curious, too, for you, Annie, and Camille, from a operations perspective, does that education happen, or is it something that you choose to compromise in the interest of providing a great experience, like the guest who asks for the manager and they don't get the person they expect? Do you take a stand? Do you not? How do you kind of deal with that particular situation? If people aren't supportive, you know, how far do you feel comfortable pushing
that? Is that like a teachable moment, or do you just let it sit? And
right.
I think that, you know, with everything changing, you know, people, they need a minute to understand things. So I always take the approach as, like, you know, being informative but chill about it. I think that there are people, though, that don't understand that and become sort of aggressive. And at that point, you know, and I'm, you know, I'm speaking from an internal space, like I'm speaking about like my co-employees, because I don't work in the front of the house. I think that I've had to, teach a lot of people that there are certain ways to adapt to the way things are happening. Mm-hmm. And I remember in one situation, there was a general manager that was just so abusive, and the owner really loved him, and because he actually worked a lot, and the owner loved that, you know, he was a workaholic, and he would just be so abusive and send me abusive texts, and but also physically abusive, and one and would not understand, like, you know, like, you have to chill out. And I had to kind of take things under my own hands, and I decided to just post, without his name on it, post all these horrible texts that he would send, and he quit the next day. So
a little shaming.
So, I mean, I never put his name on there, but, you know, sometimes people need to see it in a different light and really kind of have it touch them.
Yeah. Do you have advice for a female or any employee or consultant who's working in a situation like that? Like, what did you learn from that that you would want to share with other people who are facing similar challenges?
I think that early on, it's so important to tackle it. And I didn't. I kind of let it go because I was so busy with my work. And to do certain things like that, it does take energy. It does take time. But it's so important just to start taking care of certain things in the beginning and confronting them and really understanding that this is your mental health at stake. And if you feel like there's no one listening, it's so important just to leave that situation.
That zero tolerance of, like, absolutely not acceptable from day one, right? Which in some ways speaks a little bit about the Me Too movement of, you know, sometimes not addressing things and maybe waiting years, and then it's really digging inside you for all this time. And I think people are really now flourishing in that sense that, no, from day one, you do something that's not right, you're getting called out right away, and then just squashing it.
Yeah.
So that makes sense. As far as recruitment, though, when women recruiting other women, right, once they've reached the pinnacle, the top, right, of their field, how can women in hospitality actually extend their hand down to lift other women up in a responsible and ethical way, right, in the hospitality industry? Annie, how do you envision that, one female to another?
I think that, first of all, it's obviously about mentorship, and I think I just happen to see that a lot more young women reach out to me than young men, and that's kind of, I think, what you were saying earlier. It's like you just attract people who are drawn to that. Yeah, right. Which I think is great because there probably has been a lack of that for the past couple of years. And then just always remembering to make time for those people. And I try to follow up and check in to see how they're doing. And I think I remember receiving that kind of guidance when I was starting out and I was trying to quit one industry to start another. And I asked so many questions and received a lot of great answers from people. And so I think that's really, it's giving your time to people and being thoughtful. Even when you're having, like, even when you're working doubles all week or you're closing all the time, it's so easy to say, like, oh, I'm so, like, stuck in service. But really just, like, 30 minutes at the bar over a coffee in your own restaurant.
That, like, makes a difference, enough. Right?
Yeah.
And honestly, just physically being there, like, for some other female in the back of the house or front to be able to look up and see and maybe identify with, you know, oh, wow, I want to be like her when, you know, in the future, right? Regardless, again, of female or male, but I feel like sometimes in the past, maybe there was only one female in the kitchen. Maybe she was in the pastry department. Maybe there was no one else around that she could look up to and be like, wow, you know, I'm going to be the exec chef one day if that was her goal, or the GM or something like that. So it's kind of cool that there is, you know, obviously there are more of them in the kitchen and in the front where people can actually look up and be inspired too.
Yeah, I think it's also just acknowledging that we're in the spotlight. And I think that's true of all leaders, but maybe not all leaders carry that sense of responsibility. And I think as women leaders in an industry that's gradually shifting to be more egalitarian, I think we very much are the focal point, and to know that people are watching the decisions we make and the type of models that we are is really important.
And for Alita, obviously, especially on the last part of responsible and ethical way, when it comes to recruitment, you know, what are your thoughts on this? Obviously, without discrimination in play, but how can females help other females on the way up?
Well, yeah, in recruitment, we had to be very careful, and I try to always look at the skills that they're bringing to the table and the cultural fit. But to piggyback on Sarah's point, I do think it's our responsibility, and I really look at it more as I'm not helping others, I'm actually helping myself. So it's part of my development to help other people. It's part of my development to mentor others and to share best practices or share experiences with other females coming up. And so I think that change in thinking is also helpful, because if you're looking at it like, oh, I'm just helping you, you might not make time for it as much. But if you look at it as part of my development, I have to spend at least a half an hour of my time every week focusing on somebody else's development. It could be very powerful.
It's like a self-improvement thing. So it changes a little bit of the focus of it. That makes sense.
Alita, I'm also curious from the perspective of HR, how you try to attain that balance or that lack of bias in the recruiting process. There's recent legislation in New York that prohibits us from asking someone's salary history, for example, which is meant to level the playing field for women and minorities. So I wonder if there are other best practices you can share in terms of cultivating more fairness in the hiring process.
Well, I've always looked for diversity in my team. So on any team, whether it's a restaurant management team, I don't want all white males, because that is going to stifle growth in that restaurant, or that's going to stifle people speaking out. So I want different ethnicities, different sexes, so that anybody is comfortable speaking up or coming to somebody on the management team. And I look at that throughout every department. So marketing team, I want diversity, and HR team. And so I think if you look at it that way, not just sexes, but the nationality and the background, and you look at it from a truly inclusive perspective, making sure that everybody is represented, you can get out of the whole
That's smart.
Recruiting issue.
Exactly, because then at the whole point, we were talking about this, having a nice little juicy conversation off mic about leveling the play field, right? Of making sure that there's going to be a little bit of catching up to do on the female side. And once that's the case, then it's hopefully we don't have to be talking about this anymore. It'll just happen, and it'll be a little bit more egalitarian. Another interesting question, and this is something that made me a little furious when I read about this, but obviously we're hearing a lot about this best female this, best female that, best female chef, best female pastry chef. It's being thrown around over the last maybe couple of years. Is that helping, you know, carve out recognition, or is that really taking a step backwards? And again, this was, I remember reading the Dominic Crenn Best Chef thing. Right. And it's oddly enough, I just spoke to them this week, the, you know, their team, to work on some needs that they have in San Fran. And I remembered that. And I was like, wow, you know, how does she feel about that, reading that instead of just Best Chef? It's like Best Female Chef. That just infuriates me as a male. I don't know how you guys feel about it. Camille, how do you, how does that resonate?
You know, I haven't really thought about it too much, but I will say, like, we grew up in a society that it, you know, for music, for actors, you know, there is that category, best female actor, best male actor. Mm-hmm. And so now that we're in a position to sort of right certain wrongs within our personal industry of restaurants and hospitality, I don't know how I feel about that. I mean, I came up in a time where, you know, I didn't really get any accolades. And so I don't know that I'm in the position to, I would have to think about it. I don't know. I mean, I guess it's sort of weird, but then also, then why are music and...
Yeah, and it's funny you mentioned that, because actor, and just like chef, I mean, there's the word actress, but you still call them actors, right? And chef, too, is not like a female, you know, there's no word for a female chef, it's a chef. I don't know.
I think that was such a good point, because I think it did sit wrong with me when that award came out, and it's because it's not best male chef and best female chef. It's best chef and then best
female
chef. Exactly.
There's no best male chef.
And so it felt like, and you know, I think the World's 50 Best has gotten some criticism for being so predominantly white and so predominantly male. And this, what it felt like, this was their like, oh, well, here's like our small effort in correcting it. Right. I think it's a really great step. Like, it's progress, but I just don't want that to be the only thing that they change and how they assess, however they construe World's 50 Best.
And I would say, Annie, to your approach with King, your goal was to be the best restaurant you could be, not the best female-owned restaurant you could be. So I think it supports that point, that how is being female relevant to the quality of what you're producing. Yeah.
And just even thinking about it a little bit more, I guess, you know, thinking about like actors and musicians, I mean, I guess when you're a male actor, you can only take sort of male roles. I mean, is that the difference there? And if so, then maybe, you know, a chef shouldn't be categorized within their gender.
Mm-hmm. And music's music, right? At the end of the day, I mean, an artist, to me, it's just crazy that there's the male and female division there. I mean, you're creating art, right? I mean, what about paintings, right? I mean, you're going to say, oh, Picasso was the best male. I mean, it's like,
right.
Come on.
I mean, we're entering an age where, you know, race and sex are becoming, we want them to become obsolete. We don't want that sort of barrier within us. And so I think that if we're in the beginning of something within our field that we don't feel is right, then I think now's the time to change it. Yeah.
Yeah, 100%.
Agree to that. With that, we're going to move on to some retention questions, right? The second part of the show. We talked about recruitment. We're going to talk about retention. And then we'll keep going.
Okay, perfect. So I wanted to kick it off speaking about retention with the question, what are some innovative ways you're retaining your best employees? And I'll start with you, Alita, from a HR perspective. I'm sure you can illuminate quite a bit. And I would add to that the question of how do you identify who your best employees are as well when we're considering who to keep and who not to keep?
Yeah, so I'll answer that part first. I think that we try to look at it from a holistic perspective. So we were talking prior to the show about how, you know, somebody could be viewed as a great employee because they're such a hard worker, but they might not fit in culturally. They might not exude this amazing presence or be super warm and respectful to others. And so we're really trying to look at things, not just are they really hard workers or can they complete that task quickly, but do they fit into our culture? Do they lead with respect and warmth? And so viewing it from that perspective, I think it's changing the way that our managers are evaluating their teams. For us, we really try to look at providing a very clear growth path for our employees. We truly, when it comes to retention, we want to make sure that every employee feels seen, heard, appreciated, and are given the tools that they need to succeed. And we find that if we do those things well, we will retain the best workers on our team, because we see that everybody does want to be seen. They want to be acknowledged. They want to feel valued. They want to be heard. They want their contributions to be acknowledged, and they want to feel like they have a seat at the table, and they want to be appreciated. It's definitely a new day and age in the restaurant field, and people are not going to stick around just for their paycheck anymore. Mm-hmm. So the little things like thank yous, the little things like acknowledging their birthday and connecting on a human level, I think go a really, really long way.
That's a good point you just mentioned. It's so nomadic nowadays. From a recruiting standpoint, we see that now where, you know, it used to be 2 to 3 years longevity. It's like, wow, pretty cool resume. Forget it. Those days are over. I mean, a year and you're already like salivating. It's like people are really bouncing. And it's because of that. If you're not getting treated well, you know, people aren't sticking around.
People want to feel like they have a space.
Yeah, they move on and there's other options and they're not going to take that crap from people.
And they also want to know what it takes to win. I mean, what does winning look like? How do I know that I'm doing a good job? And if you very clearly lay that out, this is what winning looks like. This is how we're going to evaluate you. This is what it means to do a good job. They appreciate that.
How have you seen that change over time? Because I think we always bring up the M word, millennials. We should be talking about Generation Z now as well. But how do you see those generations that are newer to the workforce changing the way that you as a company need to act to retain them?
Well, I give them all the credit because they are the reason that we focus on these things. Back when I was in operations, it was, you are lucky to have a job. Do not complain or else can get somebody else in here that would very happily take your tables and take your tips. And so all of this other stuff, how you felt, did not matter. They did not care. It was serve your tables. And I think it's because of these new emerging leaders that are coming up that are changing the way that we view retention, that are changing the way that we view a great work environment. And
the tables have flipped a little bit, and we also deal with this on the recruitment side where we're coaching our candidates going into interviews, and we're saying, guys, this is very much a two-way street now. It used to be you know, you sit there, you answer questions, you know, you shake their hand and you walk away. Mm-hmm. You're interviewing them as much as they're interviewing you. Yeah. And a lot of times we'll see that people are coming in. It sounds great on paper, great opportunity. After the interview, they bounce. It's not interesting. Mm-hmm. And there's something about the culture that doesn't resonate. They asked the right questions, didn't get the answers that they were expecting or wanting, and they're not taking that position.
For operators who are viewing the Gen Z millennial challenge as a negative, what advice would you give them as an HR practitioner, as a culture champion? How should their perspective change, and how can they view some of these new, unique challenges as a positive?
Well, I think it's going back to the drawing board and not just holding on to what was, understanding that change is happening, whether you want to get on board or not. So if you want to be successful, you're going to wrap your head around how these changes are going to affect you and how you're going to change your practices. I was also dealing with getting on board to this whole thing a couple years ago. Simon Sinek did an amazing TED Talk around millennials, and it got me to change the way I viewed things and understand a little bit more of the whys and become a little bit more empathetic to what they bring to the table. And that really got me on the right page, I think.
Yeah. Camille, what are your thoughts in terms of retaining talent in this new workforce?
Yeah, I think as a chef and as someone leading a kitchen, I think there is a difference between being the sort of like captain and more of being a teacher. I think as a chef, we really are teachers because this is a craft that we're doing, and we are showing these people how to do it the best that one knows how. And so I think that when chefs sort of take that mind frame on as like, I'm helping you, I'm teaching you this, it kind of softens a lot of that sort of, I know best, you know, do this way, or teaching someone or telling someone to do it. I think I've always tried to sort of teach gently and always be very supportive of their end product. But also like be a student, because I think that when young cooks and young chefs are doing things over and over again, they really want to participate in and just creating their own thing as well. And I think that that's super important for retaining is giving
young them the space to make their mark.
Yeah, and chefs to come to you, to feel comfortable, to come to you and say, hey, this is a way of doing it, or do you know this ingredient, or I love this ingredient. Can I work on something with you to put on the menu? Like, that's so encouraging, I think, for young chefs.
How do you feel you do that? How do you encourage people to feel that level of comfort where it might not be the norm that they're welcome to share input?
Well, I don't think it's that I do anything specifically. I just don't critique. I don't criticize. I don't. I feel like I want them to be comfortable in their craft. And really that's how I was given, or when I studied my craft and once I kind of got comfortable within my craft, that's when I was really able to be, expressive. And so I just want to, I'm sort of giving them a playing field to be comfortable in their craft so that they can express themselves.
Yeah, that's great. Annie, from your perspective, we talked a bit about career development and growth and creating this clear roadmap, welcoming people to have creativity. What other things do you feel make for strong retention in your experience?
I think, and this is something that we've heard from our staff, but I think we have a lot of compassion for the things that happen in life. And because I'm someone who, like, I think there are people who can, like, really work through a personal crisis and, like, you know, put on, like, a kind of poker face. I'm not one of those people. I've never been one of those people. The number of times I've cried at my work before King and, like, throughout the opening of King is countless. And so whenever my staff have come to me with personal issues or, you know, having a moment where they, like, need to step out, like, I'm just like, I know what it feels like to be in that moment. Like, of course you can leave early tonight because you're not feeling well. And, like, I don't think anyone takes advantage of that. I think they really appreciate it because there's a lot happening in everyone's personal life and you never really know the full extent of it. And I think the only thing you can do is trust them and be compassionate and know that they, you know, I 100% trust their loyalty to the restaurant and that they want the restaurant to be the best it can be. And so when they need a second, whether it's a last minute, like they can't work the shift or they need to step out early or they just need someone to talk to, like in the middle of their double, I think we're always really open to that. And we always tell people, like,
feel more humanity, less policies, right? Just be like,
which
warm.
I know is maybe not great best HR practices to an extent. Wow. I think it works for us in the small restaurant that we are.
As long
are.
As you're consistent.
Yes. Yes.
You don't discriminate your humanity.
Yeah.
You're good to everybody.
Yeah. And we, I think that's really, it's just the way we've all, like, naturally managed.
Well, and one of the things I've become very interested in is Gen Z and what are their unique positive traits. And one of the alternate names for Gen Z is True Gen, the true generation, because they're on this perpetual quest to be true to themselves.
What age group is this? What are we talking about?
So this is anyone born in the 2000s.
Got it.
So we're talking the generation entering the workforce now.
Okay.
And there's a benefit to that. And it really, I think, jives well with what you were saying, Annie, about welcoming people to express what they're feeling or to feel comfortable bringing forward personal challenges. This is a generation that truly puts a lot of value on who they are and what their challenges are. And I think if you can mirror that as a mentor and a boss, that can be a very empowering thing for them to see someone who's in a position of authority, who's actually comfortable with kind of bearing their soul, so to speak. So I agree. And I think from an HR perspective, you'd probably agree, Alita, I think being human is a best practice.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I think we all want to work for people that understand that life happens.
Yeah, definitely. So one more question. What happens if you know right away that you made a poor hire? And Alita and Annie, I'd love to hear your input on that. And then I'd love to actually flip it, Camille, for you and talk a bit about, from an employee perspective, finding the right company and what you should do if you feel you've picked the wrong company. So maybe, Annie, we could start with you. What, maybe from prior experience or not, but what do you do once you realize that you've hired the wrong person?
Well, I think over time I've gotten so much better at listening to my gut, and it's about, like, for a small restaurant, culture is very important because we all work in such close quarters together. And so I always make sure I'm, like, asking for feedback from the other managers. But if I've already made the hire and it's been a poor hire, well, first, you know, we always tell everyone the first 3 months is a trial. And you're not fully hired until we have that evaluation at the end of your 3 month trial. But second, I've been super honest. I've sat people down and I've been, like, truthful, like, hey, I don't think this is a good fit because of X, Y, and Z reason. And what I found more often than not, actually, it's like a weird thing at King, is that most of the time they feel the same way. They feel the same way. They're like, yeah, I don't think this is a good fit either. Or like, yeah, I'm not really happy. Or yeah, actually there's all of this stuff that's been happening in my personal life and I've been having a really hard time.
And you're like, when were you going to tell me that you know?
And it tends to be like, if you're communicating and if you're being honest, it tends to be true both ways. And so it makes the conversation a lot easier.
Yeah. Alita, how about you from a larger company standpoint? What are some of the processes that you have in place to help your managers deal with a situation of hiring the wrong person?
Well, I think a probationary period is a saving grace so that you can have that time
to... You have that out.
Yes. But same exact thing. I think that having that honest conversation, 99% of the time, the person physically, like, you can tell, relaxes because they say, yeah, I'm not feeling it either. Or, yep, I agree, this is not going well. And to your question, I think they are waiting for somebody to either come along and save them and give them another job or waiting for you to make that hard call.
Right. Not so different than the dating scene, I would say.
It's very similar. Very, very similar. Yeah. But when you're honest and you're authentic and you're transparent, I think that's the way to go.
Yeah, and I would just reinforce that as an HR professional, sometimes I cringe when people talk about the introductory period or the probationary period because it doesn't remove the obligation to communicate. And I do think sometimes with clients we've supported and restaurants where I've worked in the past, there's a sense that you don't have to communicate about someone's performance until they've passed that period.
Oh dear.
When in reality,
you can know right away and then you're sitting on it.
In reality, we're saying it's a getting to know you period. So it's a bit easier for us to say, thank you, it's not a fit in that time frame, but it doesn't remove the obligation to communicate about how that person's doing. So Camille, I'm curious from your perspective. You start working with a restaurant group. You realize, as I know you have, all of us have in hospitality, that it is a toxic work environment or there's something that makes it not a fit. How do you know that? And what should you do as an employee if you're in that position?
Yeah, so I would say for the past four restaurants that I've worked on, it's been an interesting situation in that I would meet someone who wanted to open a restaurant. So it wasn't already a running restaurant. And they would come to me and ask me to work on it and to develop a concept for a restaurant. And it's usually downtown where I've lived in for a very long time. It's usually people with some money who want this title of being a restaurateur. It's really hard. It's very hard. For me, it's been very hard to understand if it's the right fit because there's nothing to go by. We haven't done any real work. The restaurant hasn't opened. I think in the beginning, has come to me and has been very excited and has promised me a lot and has, you know, given me such freedom to do everything that I want to do. And so it's been very hard for me to understand, you know, if it's a right fit or not, because they're just yesing me. But once the restaurant opens, it starts becoming evident in so many different ways. And I think, first of all, the way they manage money is always something to look at, how they do it. If they have enough funding, if they're comfortable with their funding, then how much are they trying? I also always look at how much they're trying to be a part of it. You know, some don't want anything to do with it and they stay out of it and they hire other people. And some are in it, but without any experience. And I think that that's really kind of so tough to work with a restaurateur that hasn't had any experience. Mm-hmm. So I think like those are really the two big points. And to be honest with you, the third one is, you know, people who want to have a restaurant so that they can have some type of publicity shown on them. And that I've had to encounter once, and that's so tough because they become jealous mm-hmm. of your work that you've actually done for many, many years and don't understand
the spotlight.
Why. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think the big things to look out for is to understand where funding is coming from and also understand how they see themselves within the daily workings of a restaurant.
Yeah. And I would second that as well. I think with Empowered Hospitality, it's been a bit of an exercise in learning how to find good clients and how to assess clients before we get started. I know, Mike, yes. with One House, you've had that experience as well. And it goes the same for anyone who's interviewing for any job. Mm-hmm. I think for me, it's boiled down to peeling back the layers. The first person you meet is probably not the person who ultimately is going to make the decisions that affect the job you do. And so the person that you meet is positive and enthusiastic.
Ambassador
and
of the brand.
Seems like a culture yeah. fit. And then you discover there's this owner who maybe doesn't even live in the United States who's making all of these decisions that affect your job. And I found that really trying to understand what that leadership structure looks like and who is the ultimate decision maker has helped in some cases avoid some pain. But I do think it's a process. And I would say as soon as you know it's not a fit, exit as soon as you can.
Yeah. To add on to that, I will say for anyone that's listening out there that is already post-hire, right, that has a job, just took a job, maybe, I don't care if it's 1 month ago, 6 months ago, don't stay there for the fear of what it's going to look like on your resume, right? And I just met with someone last night, a great sommelier who's worked at two of Manhattan's great fine dining restaurants as a somm, 5 month stint, 4 month stint. And she was very stressed out about it and what that looks like on her resume. And can she find another job
Absolutely.
In New York? And I say, you know what? And I talked about this, you know, with the team a lot. It's like, don't discriminate on those. Hear the story. Find out what happened there, right? Clearly, if you have 17 3-month stints, guess what? Then it's you, right? But a couple of them, hear them out. Hear their story out. And I say, don't stay in that position. look for another job. Don't be treated like crap, whether it's the first day or the second month. Look for an out. You don't deserve to stay in a place like that that's toxic. And together, I think all of us can start eradicating some of those bad apples. And even just, Sarah, you and I dumping, quote unquote, dumping clients that aren't doing the right thing. You know, let two or three other recruiters like us do the same thing to them. Eventually, their well's going to dry out and maybe the restaurant will close and they'll learn the hard way. But it shouldn't have to be a candidate that feels like he or she's stuck at a job and being treated like crap.
I actually look at it as a positive. When somebody comes to me and they say, I was at this place for 2, 3, 4 months, and I ask, why did you leave? And they tell me it was not a cultural fit, and I could not bear working there anymore. It tells me that they have integrity and that I want to kind of dig a little bit deeper to see what I can do with that.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it was very much like, oh my gosh, how's the public going to look at me if I've just opened this restaurant and now I'm leaving it? I mean, it's, and no, actually,
you shouldn't have shame about that.
But no, you're principled.
No, I mean, I do it and I don't care, but there has been, I remember someone coming up to me and saying, yeah, this person doesn't, was going to feature you in this magazine and now won't because they think that you can't be in a restaurant for more than a year or two. Mm-hmm. And that was so painful at first because that's what people kind of, especially in this industry, think. And, but I think the most important thing is like to really not care and to always know your worth and understand that if something is not happening for you and, or you're not being, I mean, in many cases, I just wouldn't be paid for months and I think at some point, you know, you just realize, oh, I have to cut my losses. At this point, from the four restaurants that I've worked on the past four, I'm owed $160,000 from them.
Wow.
And so, so, I mean, this is sort of like the work that, you know, this is what was happening prior to things kind of opening up. And that note that I said, like, when I was confronted with this horrible GM and I kind of, wanted to do right. And the only way I can think of was to do that. It was because I had just seen something on Cherry Bomb that was talking about that. And it really gave me the courage. And so all these facets, while we don't love these like all women situations, they have been proving to give women the support that is needed to for us to come to a certain equal standpoint.
Absolutely.
That's a good segue to a little break. We're going to take a little break and we're going to be back in 1 minute.
Setting the table begins long before the glassware is polished, before the china is set, spotless, on the table. Setting the table begins with selecting the right people for your team. Everything flows from the expertise, innate hospitality, and critical thinking of the people who act as ambassadors to your guests every day. With One House, a recruitment firm providing a tailored talent search to hospitality operators, finding the right people is a simple recipe. One House identifies, contacts, and interviews prospective talent and conducts pre-hire reference checks. One House also assists in curating chef tasting menus and liaises between candidate and operator throughout the interview process. Empowered Hospitality delivers human resources solutions to growing hospitality companies, presenting solutions that empower owners and operators with the knowledge, guidance, and time to better grow their businesses. Empowered Hospitality Solutions include a fully outsourced HR department, a la carte recruitment, compliance, and HR hotline services, training and education, and strategic advisement.
What is it that we are? All right, all right.
Here we are.
We're back, and here we go. So we talked about a little bit of recruitment, a little retention, and then the final R,
relaxation,
which we all need so we don't go batshit crazy in this industry. It's kind of a quick fire for everybody. We're going to start with Alita right next to me here. Day off treat, spa or outdoor activity?
Oh, spa.
Spa
I'm
all the
way?
I'm
a huge spa junkie. Yeah? Yes. Yes. Spa? Love spas.
Camille?
I would say spa. I want to just kind of conserve my energy.
Yeah? No one likes the mountains, the trails? No?
Maybe on the second day off. Right.
And I'm going to have to say a spa as well.
Oh, wow.
Sorry, New York City kid. Don't know what the outdoors is.
Spa day it is. Wow. All right. What about you, Sarah?
Oh, I am I'm a outdoorsy kind of girl.
All right.
Actually. Spas right. make me nervous.
Got it.
Midnight guilty pleasure. What are you breaking out when you get home at midnight?
And this is for eating.
You
by
just
the way.
Need a snack.
So you got to mention.
Please keep it PG.
Yeah.
Wine and brownies.
Ooh,
yeah, nice. That's a good combo for me.
Mine is boring. I'm like obsessed with lime ice pops.
Ooh, las Yama. Paletas, like the Mexican paletas. Ooh.
Unique and delicious.
Nice. My late night guilty pleasure is definitely Blue Ribbon Brasserie. It's oh, really
classic.
I lived across yes. it from a year. I had to place a moratorium.
The seafood tower, like the whole.
Yeah, the poo-poo platter, you know, the whole thing.
Oh man,
Mike, what about you?
Guilty pleasure. I'm a Häagen-Dazs guy. Sorry, and it's I got to find it sometimes in back in Spain, back home. I got to search for my Häagen-Dazs, but that's it.
Yeah.
That's what's in the freezer. What? Here's another one: Coachella or Burning Man?
Burning Man.
Burning Man?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah?
Definitely.
Experiential.
Yeah, I have a lot of friends that go religiously.
Nice. Camille?
Coachella.
Coachella. Okay. Music?
Neither. I don't, I don't like music festivals.
You're like spa.
I'm going to the spa. I'll be at the spa. Oh,
yeah. I agree with you, Annie.
Yeah, I'm Coachella all the way. I'm too old to do this whole Burning Man thing with dust in my face. I want good food trucks. I want to hear some good music. last one, bucket list travel destinations. Again, money's not an object. You got a gazillion dollars. You need to go somewhere for a week. Where do you go?
Maldives. Is that, am I saying it correctly? Maldives.
Yeah. It's the destination.
For sure. The hut over the water. That's my gig. Yeah.
All right.
Japan.
Oh, I love Japan. That's
especially with no money.
Like being an object. Yeah.
Like, definitely Japan.
Right? Yeah, because if you go with no money, lots of rice. And he's like...
got back from Japan. Yeah. Vietnam.
I thought you were going to say spa. Vietnam's another good one.
Yeah.
Nice.
Me. I've always wanted to go to New Zealand, but haven't been able to go yet.
Nice. That is far. I'm with Camille. It's Japan all the way for me. I'm trying to plan my snowboarding trip next winter.
Amazing.
So, very cool.
Yeah. Thank you all so much for joining us.
Thank you. This has
been really illuminating. I think we could probably talk for another hour. And hopefully we'll continue the conversation off mic. But I just want to take a moment to thank...
What did I say? What do you mean off mic? Again, okay, see, it's females only.
That was a good pun.
But yeah, you can catch this interview, past and future ones, at heritageradionetwork.org, iTunes, and Spotify. Until next time, remember, love your staff and they will love you back.
Thanks. I've got to stay inside while the sun goes by.
This program is powered by Simplecast.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Heritage_Radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
listeners, we want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Awaeli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, the French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.